About the third time something like that happens, you start to think the world is a stranger place than you always thought. Kip nodded. Or maybe I'm losing my mind. Kip shook his head. No. Well, I guess there's no going back to bed. Maybe you don't need to pee, but I do. Then we're out of here. Chapter 55. Megan pulled the door open, let it arc under its own momentum, shielding behind it as it moved, and no one burst into the bedroom. She had both hands on the pistol as the door swung past her to reveal the hallway. As she cleared the threshold, the spill of light issuing from her suite proved barely sufficient for her to see that the hall was deserted. Woody's quarters lay to her left, toward the front of the house. To her right were two guest rooms, a bath and a hall closet. The intruder could be in any of them, door ajar, watching through the gap. Opposite Woody's suite was a sewing room that she used for storage, and maybe the door stood ajar, maybe not. She didn't dare turn her back on the guest wing, and she needed to keep an eye on that sewing room. So she put her back to the wall, just to the left of the door that she'd come through. Before she began to move, she listened, trying to hear through the lamentations of the wind that, in their volume and quality of distress, might have been a threnody for the death of the world itself. But the rainless storm was a mask of sound, behind which footsteps or any other telltale noises could not be heard. Her heart knocking to the frantic tempo of the wind, she eased sideways, turning her head left and right, the one eye of the pistol tracking where her two eyes looked. She came to Woody's room without incident. As she stepped inside, she urgently whispered his name. Before she could close the door behind her, she saw her son on the bed, lying on his left side, his back to her, a man kneeling in soft lamplight at bedside, face to face with her boy. "Here comes Mommy," the intruder said. "You know how hot your mommy is? Way too hot to waste her life with a dummy like you." Chapter 56. The wind was a mad spirit, howling along the alleyway as though through the halls of Bedlam, flailing against the brick walls of the buildings. The guy named Zellman, surely experienced in the handling of the dead, whether as an assistant medical examiner or otherwise, drove the morgue wagon with two cadavers aboard. Frawley the Fixer followed in the Shelby Supersnake that had belonged to the late Peyton Spater, which had been transferred to the custody of the state attorney general along with the bodies and other evidence. Both vehicles turned right into the town square and out of sight, taking their light with them. In the wind-shaken gloom, Carson Conroy said, "This is so not right." Sheriff Ekman shrugged. "It is what it is." He went to the side entrance out of which he'd come earlier and disappeared into his elected domain. Carson heard that expression more often these days, "It is what it is," and it nettled him every time someone spoke it. He wanted to say to Ekman, "You are what you are, and now I know what that is." He held his tongue, because in the next election the voters might wise up and cast their ballots for a new sheriff. In the meantime, Carson didn't want to be forced out of his job. In spite of the late hour, he left the wind to its raging and returned to his office. At his computer, he accessed the National Crime Information Center website and went to the list of people for whom arrest warrants were outstanding. He sought the name Nathan Palmer and began to make a list of curious facts. Chapter 57. For an instant, Megan didn't recognize the intruder. But then she identified him by his voice, which she had heard earlier in the day on the phone. Lee Shackett. His hair was no longer blonde, but brown. His neatly trimmed beard had been shaved off. Other changes in his appearance were too subtle to pinpoint, but he had about him a disturbing otherness. Woody lay motionless, and when she spoke his name louder than before, he didn't respond with any movement. Her thundering heart pounded faster, and she thought, "What have you done to him, you son of a bitch?" Shackett's right hand was on Woody's head, on Woody's face. Megan had the heckler in a two-hand grip, just like she'd been taught, the front sight fixed on Shackett's face, the only thing she could see of him as he knelt at the other side of the bed, the boy between them. But her knocking heart shook her arms, something that never happened on a shooting range. At 20-some feet, even when you were ready steady. A head shot was a tricky deal, a chest shot always better. "Mommy wants to shoot the $100 million man," Shackett said. "Your mommy doesn't know what's good for her. But she'll learn soon enough." She gave voice to her fear. "What have you done to him?" His smile was wolfish. "Just touched him. Being touched seems to traumatize the little dummy. He's stiff as a board, petrified. He doesn't like being touched, at least not by me." As Shackett stroked Woody's face with one hand, Megan said, "Get away. Get away from him." "He doesn't like being touched by me," Shackett repeated, continuing to touch the boy. "The little freak is a big snob, just like his mommy. Mommy Megan thinks she's so much better than other people. Even $100 million man isn't good enough to touch her." She dared to take a step closer to him. Another step, but she couldn't yet keep the front sight where it needed to be, her heart beating so loud in her ears that she could no longer hear the windstorm if it still raged. Even in her paranoid days, when she'd first moved here and imagined 100 scenarios in which nothing but a gun would save her and Woody, she hadn't foreseen a situation like this. With the boy intervening between her and a threat, the only possible shot too dangerous to take. "I called the police," she lied.
"That would be too bad if you did. That would be a big mistake."
"We all make mistakes, though, don't we, Megan? I made one when I left my pistol in your kitchen earlier, after I ate that hot bitch's tits." He snickered and shook his head. "No, that's not right. It was a steak. In your kitchen, it was a steak. And it wasn't as good as Justine's breasts." Maybe drugs fueled Shackett, but he was also inarguably insane. He began to lose control of his face, features failing to cooperate in a coherent expression. Twitches and ticks and squints and crooked grins and ill-formed frowns contested ceaselessly. His increasing instability and his claim of cannibalism were force magnifiers for Megan's fear. Her chest became tight, and she drew breath in ragged inhalations. He said, "There would be no future for any of us if you really did call the police." "But you're a terrible liar, Megan. I smell the deception as surely as I smell your twat. Now let me tell you what's going to happen. I'm going to have my fantasy after all. You and me. Just like it always should have been. You know where my right hand is?
Get away from him."
"Do you know where my right hand is?" he shouted, the lamplight lending an eerie glow to his eyes.
"Your hand's on his face," she said.
"But you can't see precisely how it's placed. The dummy's eyes are closed, Megan. My thumb is on his right lid, my forefinger on his left. Can you picture that, Megan? I could press hard, dig deep, take out his eyes in 2 seconds. Then he'd be mute, blind, stupid, 3 times useless."
He put his left hand to the back of Woody's head to prevent him from pulling away. "You want me to gouge out his eyes, or you want to stop where you are and discuss options?"
"You fucking creep. You're dead if you hurt him."
"Megan, Megan, Megan. You're in no position to be so rude. Get off your high horse for once."
She didn't dare take another step. Still didn't have the shot she needed. Blood sang in her ears as shrill as tinnitus.
"You want to take a shot, Megan? Go ahead and take a shot."
He thought the pistol wasn't loaded. If she took a shot and missed, he would blind Woody.
"Do you feel lucky, Megan?"
"No."
"Do you still think you're better than me?"
"I never said I was better than you."
"But you thought it. Don't lie to me."
"I smell your lies.
Be truthful with me, or the dummy pays."
"All right, yes. I thought I was better than you.
But now... now I've been in your cozy house all afternoon, all evening, doing what I please, and you were clueless. Do you still think you're better than me? Smarter than me?"
"No."
"Say it."
"I don't think I'm better than you. or smarter.
I hope that's true. For the dummy's sake, I hope that's true, Megan. I hope you've learned and you're chastened. I feel his eyes moving under the lids, like when a dreamer dreams and there's rapid eye movement.
So there are three things I want you to do, Megan.
Are you with me?
Yes, I'm with you.
First, I want you to put down the gun.
Second,
I want you to take off what you're wearing. Third, I want you to lie down on the bed and spread those long, lovely legs for me.
Here? Of course, here.
Are you worried about corrupting a minor?
The juvenile snicker again.
The dummy won't even understand what we're doing. He'll lie here sucking his thumb while we make a better baby than him, a baby for the new world becoming.
Don't hurt him.
Don't make me hurt him, Jason's little freak. You understand how much I would like to hurt him, Megan?
I think so, yes.
For you, just for you, I'm not hurting the little dummy. We're making a bargain here. You're not as smart as you think you are. You don't know what you think you know.
By that he probably meant that she didn't know he had taken the ammunition out of her pistol. He was taunting her. He wanted her to pull the trigger, experience the shock of its failure to fire.
Where do you want me to put down the gun?
On the bed. Be very, very careful, Megan. If you try anything, you'll be surprised how badly it works out for you and him. You try anything, and it doesn't work out, I'll take his eyes, and that will be on you, his blindness on you forever.
The moment had come. The boy was his shield, even though he didn't believe he needed a shield. He had an animal cunning. She wasn't going to get a clearer shot than the one the next minute might offer. As she approached him, she didn't lower the pistol, hoping he would tempt her by rising up just a little, putting slightly more space between his head and Woody. Fear of what might happen abruptly became an abhorrence of allowing it to happen, and in an instant her tremors stopped, her aim steadied, the front sight fixed on his face, and as she reached the bed, she squeezed off a shot. Maybe he smelled her deception. He juked as she was about to fire, and the bullet tore his left ear. He howled like an animal, didn't blind the boy, but instead, as fast as a skink, inhumanly fast, he swept Woody off the bed, into his arms, using him as a shield. She didn't dare another shot. The bathroom door stood just 3 steps away, and Shackett was through it, slamming it behind him.
Sweet Jesus, so crazy fast, so supernaturally fast, she knew in an instant he hadn't been warning her just that her pistol might be empty when he had said, "You don't know what you think you know."
Something else must be going on with him, something beyond easy comprehension. She tried the door. It was locked. He was going to blind Woody. She fired 2 rounds into the latch, shouldered the door, crashed through into a tumult of wind, rattling the medicine cabinet, flapping the towels on the rack. Woody on the floor, in the corner by the shower, his beautiful eyes wider than they'd ever been, staring at something far beyond this room. To her right, the lower sash of the tall, double-hung window open, Shackett going through, no alarm wailing, because no porch roof beyond. A fleeting glimpse of him, hunched and troll-like on the sill, under the sash, looking over his shoulder, his eyes wild and shot with light, hissing at her through clenched teeth, hissing like some reptile, and dropping away into the dark. She stepped to the window, saw he'd landed on all fours, maybe 15 feet below, like a cat, clad in black in the black night, looking up at her, his face a pale oval, as ghostly as that of a spirit wandering between worlds. Then quick across the lawn, toward the front of the property, the highway, and out of sight. She put her pistol down on the vanity, slammed the window, gasping for breath as if she'd been running for her life. She went to Woody, knelt before him on the cold bathroom tile. Blood. Oh, God, spatters of blood. Yes, but not his. Blood from Shackett's torn ear. She touched Woody's face, smoothed his hair, picked up his hands and kissed them, all the while telling him it was all right, they were safe, the bad man was gone, she was so sorry, sorry this happened, but it was over. Woody wasn't here with her. Sometimes he withdrew, and there was no reaching him, no indication that he saw her or heard her.
He went away somewhere when he was badly stressed, although she seldom knew what stressed him. Couldn't get in his mind to learn the source of his upset, though, of course, she knew this time. She sat on the floor and put her arms around Woody, pulling him into her lap as best she could, rocking him. "It's all right, baby. Everything's okay now." Glass shattered in a downstairs room, and a glass break sensor set off the security alarm. Shackett had returned. Chapter 58. One lane of Highway 89 was finally cleared, and the highway patrol allowed southbound and northbound traffic to get past the remaining wreckage in alternating waves. The heavy fog began to lift as Rosa Leon drove inland from the lake toward Tahoe City. By the time she found herself 2 miles from Olympic Village, the last rags of mist raveled into darkness behind her, and the night ahead lay clear but starless under an overcast. She had dozed off twice during the hours she'd waited in line for the overturned 18-wheeler to be moved to one side of the highway, and now she yawned extravagantly. This had been a long day, wearying not just because of its length, but because of the sadness attendant to it. But the wonder of Kip and her responsibility for him kept her in motion. A couple miles short of Olympic Village, she consulted the Pied Finder app again. She was dismayed to see that, after remaining for hours in the same location, Kip had gone on the move once more. His blinking signifier placed him on Interstate 80, west of Truckee, heading toward Donner Summit. The speed at which he moved meant he must be aboard a vehicle. Perhaps he was in the company of a good person, or maybe someone not so good. Whoever his companion might be, that person couldn't know that Kip was more than a dog, that he was a treasure. Anyway, this wasn't anyone whom Dorothy had chosen for the role of caregiver, and Rosa would, by God, not fail Dorothy. Although she was already doing the speed limit, she pressed down on the accelerator. Chapter 59. Pistol in hand, 7 rounds remaining in the magazine, Megan hurried barefoot across Woody's bedroom, into the upstairs hallway, as Shackett threw open the front door with such force that it banged hard against its stop. He had shattered the side light and reached through to twist the thumb turn on the deadbolt. Wind seethed into the house, huffing and wailing, and the alarm shrilled, and Megan reached the head of the front stairs in time to see Shackett snatch a large vase from the foyer sideboard and throw it against the wall in a rage before he disappeared panther-quick into the hallway, heading toward the back of the house. He was insane, but he was something stronger than crazy. Wild and weird and powerful and unpredictable. If he had charged up the front stairs, she would have shot him repeatedly. But as bold as he might be, he wasn't improvident. She recalled something that he'd said. "We all make mistakes, though, don't we? I made one when I left my pistol in your kitchen earlier." He'd returned to get his gun. He could ascend one set of stairs or another, probably from the kitchen, firing as he reached the top. She went back into Woody's room, pushed the button in the doorknob to engage the privacy latch. A hard kick would spring that flimsy lock. Brace the door. No straight-back chair, just Woody's wheeled desk in an armchair. Shackett was coming, and coming fast. Left of the door, a 7-drawer high boy stood on 4 legs, too heavy to drag across the carpet. She tipped it, and it crashed onto its side, blocking the door to the height of the knob. The phone ringing. Alarm shrieking, wind jamming the house, and the phone ringing. She snatched the handset off the cradle, knowing it must be the alarm company, and didn't even listen, just shouted, "Man with a gun! In the house! Now, now, now!" She didn't hang up, but dropped the phone and moved to the bathroom doorway. Woody was where she had left him, but on his side now, in the fetal position. She turned her back to the boy and faced the hallway door, on the farther side of the room, wanting to kill Shackett for what he'd already done to Woody, for terrorizing the boy, for touching him. If the bastard suddenly had a come-to-Jesus moment and threw down his gun and begged forgiveness, she'd shoot him anyway. Shoot him again and again, kill him with great satisfaction. He should have been here by now. The howling wind, the creaks and rattles and thumps it raised, the insistent bleeding of the alarm, again her heart thundering. But she heard no gunshots, no pounding on the braced door. She wondered where he was, thought of how he'd gone out the window and landed on all fours in the yard, his eyes like burning coals in his moon-pale face.
Her imagination brought her a mental image of him climbing the house wall with the alacrity of a spider, raising the double-hung window from outside and entering the bathroom behind her.
Help was on its way. Armed deputies, although not likely just around the corner, still a few minutes away, when a few minutes was an eternity.
Suddenly Shackett rattled the doorknob, but only for a moment, then fired two shots at the lock, disintegrating it. He tried to shove the door open, but the highboy was heavy. He pushed harder, and the door arced an inch, 2 inches. She was at an angle to the gap, couldn't see him. But she fired at the jamb, fired again, and saw the pressure on the door relent. She had 5 rounds left.
How many did he have?
6? 8? Again he shoved hard on the door, moving the toppled highboy another inch, 2 inches. If it came to a firefight, maybe his aim would be as uncanny as his animal physicality. The solid core door was 2 inches thick. Trying to shoot him through it was likely a waste of ammunition. The door moved 2 inches, then another 2. Soon he would force entry. Judging by his rabid behavior thus far, he'd enter fast and low, firing as he came, and he would expect her to be where in fact she was, defending the entrance to the bathroom in which her troubled boy lay immobile. Megan shrank back, using the door jamb for what little cover it might offer, the pistol in a 2-hand grip, aiming at the widening gap across the room where the son of a bitch would soon appear. The distinctive waffling wail of a patrol car siren spiraled through the cacophony of wind and trilling alarm sooner than she had expected and swelling fast.
"They're coming!" she shouted at Shackett. "They're coming, you asshole! You're finished! They're coming!"
Shackett heard them too, and he ceased forcing his way into the room, maybe only for the moment, maybe permanently. Megan stood ready, acid rising in her throat, vision pulsing with the violence of her heartbeat. Chapter 60. Shackett in a fury, so strong in his becoming that he believes he can kill them all, the 2 cops responding, and the bitch and the boy. He starts boldly toward the front stairs, but cunning tamps his fury down into rage, tamps rage down into mere anger, and instead he pivots and hurries along the hallway to the back stairs, plunges down them 2 at a time. The response to the alarm might involve more than 2 cops. Even if there are only 2, they'll have pistols and shotguns, and they can call for backup. He's better than any of them, but a pack of wolves can defeat a single tiger. Across the kitchen, through the back door, onto the porch. The tempest welcomes him, as does the night, and he leaps off the porch, over the steps, into the yard. They will mount a search. He might not be able to go directly to his Dodge Demon on the Forest Service Road and flee the area before they begin stopping cars on the highway looking for him. He must be indirect. There are no deer, no dummy boy feeding them apple slices, no moonlight emanating from things instead of being reflected by them, just the rampaging wind with the first chill of autumn on its breath and all around the forest, a citadel from which the night arose and to which it will return at dawn. He races across the deepest part of the yard, toward the woods in the west. They will come into the forest with bright tack lights, seeking his spoor. But in his becoming, with his increasing night vision and enhanced sense of smell, guided by an intuitive understanding of the wilderness that no other man has ever known, he will be fleet when they are fumbling, confident when they are uncertain, and he will leave them far behind, lose them, and send them home defeated. Among the trees, both by sight and smell, he quickly finds the wandering paths that generations of deer have beaten through the underbrush, the route marked by the scent of their shed hair and musk and urine and fecal droppings. The winding trail leads through pine, cedar, fir, buckeye, soon ascending to an outcropping of rock smoothed by millennia of weather. Beyond the rock, the trail resumes and in time descends toward a stream, where the crisp night air is redolent of sedges, mosses, wild onions. What once would have been an arduous trek does not for a moment test his resources. His muscles stretch and flex with ease. As he moves through the wilderness, he is lithe and limber, as he's been before only in the dreams of his youth. He fears nothing, neither bear nor mountain lion, and he senses that his passage spreads fear through the hearts of all the creatures that live here, paralyzes the small animals that might be his prey if he chose to take them. Wind rages less here on the floor of the forest than in its higher boughs, shaking down dead needles and pine cones and birds' nests, the primeval equivalent of confetti to celebrate his passage. His sense of dominion, of sovereign authority over all that he surveys, might be expected to slake the anger that has burned in him through the previous day and now into another. Instead, the farther he gets from his humiliation at the Bookman House, the deeper into the Gothic spires of cedars and pines, the more the post-midnight darkness infuses itself into his blood. Anger escalates once more into rage, rage into fury. Escape accomplished, or the need for it forgotten, he stalks the night in hope of repeating the experience that had been more exciting and more satisfying than anything else in his life, sniffing the air for the wealth of information it carries, licking the darkness as he remembers that singular taste, gnashing his teeth and wishing they were sharper. Bella on the Wire. Dogs of the Mysterium needed less sleep than ordinary dogs. They even required less sleep than the average human being. Bella rose hours before anyone else in the Montell family. She considered herself something of a guard dog. From time to time she practiced baring her teeth before a mirror. She scared herself a little. She preferred to sleep in one of her beds on the ground floor, to more quickly become aware of any smelly intruder forcing entry. No intruder had ever breached the sanctity of the Montell home. That didn't mean it couldn't happen. Although Bella was an optimist like all of her kind, she also knew that the world was awash in evil. She could remain an optimist because she understood that the world was made exclusively for the innocent. Rooms to house the wicked weren't included in the original architecture. Eventually, the world would be remodeled to restore it to its original purpose. Now, in the early hours of Thursday, she rose from her bed in the kitchen and went into the family room and stood on her hind feet and used the wall switch to turn on the lights. She had been caught at this a few times. The family thought it was cute. Lorinda, the oldest of the children, had said, "She's afraid of the dark. I don't blame her. Just look at the news." Sam, the next of the oldest, said, "Boys aren't ever afraid of the dark," though he always slept with a nightlight aglow. Dennis, younger than Sam, said, "Maybe we have mice, and Bella needs light to catch them." "We don't have mice," Lorinda declared. "And Bella's not a cat. Anyway, she's never produced a mouse." "Maybe she eats them," Dennis said. "Bella is every inch a lady," Lorinda objected, horrified by her brother's suggestion. "Ladies don't eat mice, for God's sake." Millie, the youngest, said, "You're all full of pish-posh." Bella wasn't afraid of the dark. She just couldn't read in it. The wire wasn't merely a communication system. It was also an educational tool. Other members of the Mysterium could share their knowledge of language with a young dog in mere minutes. Solomon and Brandy, two of the more philosophical members of the Mysterium, called this ability brain-to-brain data downloading. In the family room were shelves and shelves of books. Although she was a big girl, Bella was pretty much limited in her reading to the volumes on the lower four shelves. There was a wheeled ottoman she could push across the room and stand on to reach the fifth shelf, but she rarely used it because of balance issues. She could paw a book off a shelf and return it with her teeth. If she heard footsteps and needed to ditch a book quickly, she shoved it under a skirted chair or put it on an end table to shelve it later. Sometimes Bella forgot, in which case the children were blamed for leaving books off the shelves. All but one child rightly denied it. On a few occasions, after favoring Bella with a long stare, Millie had taken the blame. Millie suspected. One day the girl might seek the truth. Bella hadn't decided what she would do then. Probably play it by heart when the time came. Now, in the wee hours of Thursday morning, she was lying in the family room reading The Magician's Elephant by Kate DiCamillo. The story was funny and sad, magical and strange, but true. True in the sense that, strange as it was, it described the matrix underlying life, a matrix of unsuspected connections among people, places, and moments widely separated in time. Bella turned the pages either by snorting out a blast of air
or by the careful brush of a paw so as not to crinkle a page. Stories were as delicious as food, as important as food. Bella could not live without stories. Stories were the greatest blessing of intelligence. They were food for the soul. They were medicine. You could live 1,000 lives through stories and learn to shape your own life into a story of the best kind. She had just finished chapter 5 and sighed with contentment when the most amazing thing happened. A new voice came on the wire. He called himself Vulcan. He claimed to be a 3-year-old German shepherd. Thus far, the Mysterium had been limited only to retrievers, Golden and Labrador. Vulcan was, of course, telling the truth. He was a dog. But there were other details even more astonishing. He was transmitting from a great distance. He had been seeking contact for a year, straining ever outward. Bella didn't know how widely the transmission had been received throughout the Mysterium. She returned the magician's elephant to the shelves and composed an announcement for immediate urgent distribution. Bellagram. Something exciting is happening out there. Until moments ago, no transmission on the wire has ever been received from beyond a 120-mile radius of Sacramento. Vulcan, a German shepherd living in La Jolla, just north of San Diego, has broken through to us with the news that there is a community of our kind in San Diego, Orange, and Riverside counties. Mostly German shepherds and Bernese mountain dogs. There are 72 of them, residing in various conditions. What we call the wire, they call the radio. They have no name for themselves, but we can hope they adopt the Mysterium for themselves. Where have we come from? Why are we here? Our story is at last unfolding. Our time seems to have come. Rejoice, be true, stay tuned. A Dog and His Boy. Thursday, 1 a.m. to 4 a.m. Chapter 61. In his first year of service, Sheriff Hayden Ekman had never before been in his office past midnight. In fact, seldom after 6 o'clock in the evening. He was there now, and worried. Still young and attractive, he could speak eloquently about the rule of law and public service, winning over any audience. But his current position was not his life's work, only one step on the staircase of a career that would take him far. He had been a deputy, rising through the ranks for 5 years, and before that he'd been a lawyer, with a less than grand practice. He still thought of himself as an attorney rather than a lawman. During the next 3 years, he intended to work tirelessly and take advantage of all the legal and quasi-legal ways a sheriff could enrich himself, and then run for the district attorney of Pinehaven County. With the ultimate goal of becoming Attorney General of the state of California, he had already begun using the resources of his office to obtain information damaging to a list of public servants who he anticipated would be his competition in future elections. Therefore, this business with Dexter Frawley, transferring the bodies of Peyton Spader and Justine Kleinman to Sacramento, that nest of vipers, and relinquishing jurisdiction in this case to the state, left him uneasy. On the one hand, the Attorney General, Tio Barbizon, now owed him a favor. On the other hand, if this situation couldn't be contained, and if it blew up on them, Hayden might suffer some damage to his image for having acceded so quickly to Barbizon's request. What most disturbed him was that he couldn't be sure he was getting the straight story from Barbizon. The AG claimed to be working in conjunction, unofficially, with a national security agency, which was eager to keep its connection to the case secret. But Barbizon withheld large parts of the story, and he had a reputation as a sharp operator. There was reason to think the claim of NSA involvement was legit. When the wallet containing the Nathan Palmer driver's license was found near the woman's corpse, Hayden had gone to the NCIC website to check if there might be a criminal history or an outstanding warrant on the guy. The warrant had been issued by a court in Salt Lake City, at the request of the Attorney General of the state of Utah, rather than by a court in the county or the town, Springville, where the crime had been committed. Palmer was wanted for suspicion of larceny, arson, and murder. While Hayden was reading what little was in the Nathan Palmer file, the screen of his computer had blanked to white, and a silhouette of his shoulders, neck, and head appeared in black. The screen remained locked for maybe 3 minutes before control was returned to him. He knew this meant his photograph had been taken and his location identified, which was a capability only of the nation's major security agencies.
One of them had a watch on the NCIC's Nathan Palmer file to see who might check it out. 20 minutes later, before he could contact the Attorney General of Utah, Hayden had received the call from Barbizon, who surprised him by asking why he had been inquiring about Nathan Palmer. When Hayden described the double homicide and the horrific savaging of Justine Kleinman, Barbizon put him on hold for 5 minutes while he conferred with others. When he returned, he'd suggested that in this matter he was a front for the NSA, which wanted the Pinehaven case against Nathan Palmer transferred to Barbizon for prosecution. He was permitted to reveal more than the details in the warrant issued by the Salt Lake City Court. Palmer had been a highly placed executive employed by Refine, with oversight of the Springville facility where 93 people died in the fire that had been big news for 2 days. The Palmer ID was, in fact, false, one of several that the man had obtained prior to events at Springville and thought were known only to him. Barbizon wasn't permitted to reveal the fugitive's real name. Nathan Palmer had bought a custom red Dodge Demon via an offshore shell corporation that he had formed. Although he thought his employer didn't know about the vehicle, he was wrong. Apparently, after purchase, the Dodge had been stripped of its GPS so that it couldn't easily be tracked. That was something his all-knowing employer hadn't known. Any lead that Hayden might develop on the Dodge would be welcome. Finally, this was a matter of national security, and Hayden was enjoined by law from repeating to anyone what little had been disclosed during this conversation. Now that Frawley and Zellman had come and gone, Hayden Ekman sat in his office, working on a pot of black coffee, wondering why Nathan Palmer, under his real name, had thought it necessary to acquire false ID in a hard-to-track vehicle. It sounded as if he either planned to sabotage the Springville plant and go on the run, or anticipated a disaster for which he might be blamed. Whatever work might have been underway there, it sure as hell hadn't been the cancer research that the media reported, in which the NSA would have had no interest. And why would Palmer's boss, knowing of his preparations to go on the run in a crisis, have kept him employed at that facility? What a snake's nest this seemed to be. A tangle of threats, yes, but also, for a man like the sheriff, a squirming mass of opportunities. Now, following the departure of Frawley and Zellman with the bodies of the victims and all associated evidence, Sheriff Ekman had settled at his desk to write a memo describing that transfer, giving special attention to the behavior of Dr. Carson Conroy. The medical examiner had questioned the propriety of the transfer, had raised issues of protocol and ethics, infuriating the sheriff. If this ever ended up in a court, Hayden wanted a version of events composed immediately afterward and time-dated that would diminish Conroy's credibility. According to Hayden's reimagining of events, the medical examiner hadn't shown up uninvited, but had been called to assist in the transfer and had arrived inebriated. Conroy hadn't questioned anything about the procedure, but in fact had been both confused and abusive toward the men from Sacramento. Hayden enjoyed writing dialogue for the drunken medical examiner and inventing convincing details of his erratic behavior, careful not to make him unbelievably clownish. If he ever needed to present this memo in court, he would first share it with Frawley and Zellman, so that they could corroborate it in their testimony. Hayden had just finished the memo, printed it, and personally filed it both electronically and physically, when Carl Fredette, the watch commander currently on duty at the front desk, buzzed him on the intercom to report a home invasion with shots fired at the residence of Megan Bookman on Greenbrier Road. Home invasions hereabouts were as rare as incidents involving elephants. Although Hayden always put his own interests above those of the community and defined corruption less strictly than did the law, he had a cop's good intuition. He suspected at once that Nathan Palmer, whoever he might really be, had not moved on from Pinehaven County. Chapter 62. Like all members of the Mysterium, Kip could turn the wire on and off as if it were a radio, though emergency transmissions always came through. He didn't turn it off now, because the boy's cry of emotional pain and desperation was a signal to home onto. Giving directions to Ben Hawkins could be accomplished without words, because the man was smart enough to believe in the impossible when evidence showed him it was possible after all. Sad to say, not all human beings were that open-minded. Some believed the most ridiculous things without a shred of evidence, but wouldn't believe a truth even when it stuck its fingers in their eyes, so to speak. Anyway, when they came to an intersection, Ben pointed and asked, "That way?"
If he pointed the right way, Kip barked once enthusiastically. If he pointed the wrong way, Kip whined with disapproval. As always, there was much he would have liked to say if he'd had the physical apparatus necessary for speech. He would have said, "You're a really good driver." He would have said, "Faster, faster," though Ben already exceeded the speed limit, aware that this was urgent business, whatever else it might be. Given speech, Kip would have asked 1,000 questions about Ben Hawkins's life. What kind of books he wrote, whether he'd read Dickens, whether he believed those physicists were right who said that there were parallel universes perhaps infinite in number. Dorothy had been fascinated by quantum mechanics and string theory and all that. She had a way of making you interested in what fascinated her. This was a theory of Kip's. There are parallel universes, and when we die, we go on living in other realities. Dorothy was lost here, but not lost everywhere. He took comfort in that. He wouldn't go so far as to say that heaven was a parallel universe where everyone lived forever. He wasn't a theologian. From Olympic Village, they went north on State Route 89, and then west on Interstate 80. They left I-80 for State Route 20, still heading west. If he were just an ordinary dog, he would as often as possible ride with his head out of the passenger door window. But he understood the danger of flying debris causing serious eye damage. Sometimes, being a super smart dog was less fun than being an ordinary dog. Maybe not just sometimes. Maybe a lot of the time. Dorothy would let him ride with his head out of the window, but then she would drive on very slowly. Not so much fun. Thus far, he had assumed that others on the wire heard the boy, but suddenly he wondered at their lack of comment. He sent, "Do you hear the boy on the wire? He screams and he cries." The answers came quickly from all points of the night. No one else heard the boy. They were excited to think that a human being might ever be on the wire. He wondered why they didn't hear the boy. Life was full of things to wonder about. When Kip growled to warn of an upcoming change of direction, his companion said, "Go right?" Kip barked, "Yes." Just then the bellogram about Vulcan and La Jolla flared in his mind, the news bright with Bella's joy. Bella was right. Something was happening out there. Something monumental. And somehow, the boy must be as much a part of it as was Vulcan and Bella and Kip and all the smart dogs who had thus far believed themselves to be strangers in a world that had spawned them for no certain purpose and set them loose to live outside of nature in perpetual longing for answers that never came. Chapter 63. After carrying Woody from the bathroom to his bed, Megan had pulled on her jeans and crew neck just as the police arrived. She was reluctant to leave Woody, who appeared to be entirely detached from reality, traumatized and withdrawn into a world of his own. This was not the first time he had traveled afar like this, of course, but she sensed a new quality to his withdrawal this time. She prayed it wasn't despair. She had gone to the head of the stairs to call down to the arriving officers, but refused to descend to the ground floor, instead insisting the deputies come to her. As she told the first officers her story, she rolled Woody's desk chair beside the bed and sat in it and held one of his hands, gently opening his clenched fingers and ceaselessly stroking them with the hope of relaxing him. She strove to remain calm, to recount events without letting the anxiety that possessed her be evident in her recitation, for fear the boy would understand that her sense of safety had been forever stolen from her by Lee Shackett. Woody needed her to be a rock on which he could stand, not a sea of dread in which he might drown. As the men listened to her, they examined the door lock that had been damaged by gunfire and explored the room without touching anything. With their solemn expressions and deadpan stares, they seemed to regard her with suspicion, which perhaps their experience and training required of them. Nevertheless, she found it difficult to conceal her exasperation that they were not urgently seeking Lee Shackett wherever he had fled into the night, assuming he had fled and wasn't nearby, waiting for them to investigate and leave. She supposed that her quiet recounting of this mad and violent encounter might have made them wonder about her veracity. Where was the residue of terror that should still leave her agitated? Where was her anger at the violation of her home? Of course, they were coiled deep inside her, as tight as the internal windings of a golf ball, so that they wouldn't be conveyed to her son. Being the parent of a developmentally disabled child who was unable to express his emotions but felt them deeply, a child who had no defense mechanisms to cope with fear, Megan needed at all times to consider how her expressed feelings affected him. He had been so traumatized by Shacket that he'd retreated into a stillness that she found disturbing, if not itself frightening, and she dared say nothing in a tone that might wind tighter the clock spring of Woody's terror. A second pair of deputies arrived within a few minutes of the first, and for whatever reason, perhaps seniority, they seemed to take charge, though they hadn't been the first responding officers. One of these was a 30-something woman, Deputy Carrickton, according to the black letters and the white name bar clipped to the breast pocket of her uniform shirt. Carrington was a cross-trainer with solid forearms, attractive, with Scandinavian features, blonde hair cropped short, and Wedgwood blue eyes. She seemed efficient, producing a notebook and pen to memorialize Megan's statement, which the first two deputies had not done. Megan was relieved to have a woman in the room, someone who could better relate to what she'd been through. Soon, though, she began to realize that, however capable Carrington might be, she seemed to have a visceral dislike of Megan, and therefore distrusted her without reason. After Megan gave them a shorthand version of what had happened, Deputy Carrington said, "What's wrong with the kid?"
"He's a high-functioning autistic."
"What's that mean, high-functioning?"
"He's a natural autodidact, reads at a college level, doesn't act out, not ever. But he can't bear to be touched by anyone other than me or Verna Brickett, the housekeeper. And he doesn't speak."
Carrington stood too close, violating Megan's personal space, staring down at her and Woody.
"The way the kid's just lying there, as though he doesn't even know I'm here. Is he always that way?"
"No. Shacket traumatized him, like I said."
"Did he molest the boy?"
"He threatened him, tormented him. When I found Shacket here, he had control. He was touching Woody's face. That's the worst for him, having his face touched by a stranger."
"I'm asking, is he traumatized because he was raped?"
"No. Shacket meant to rape me, and torment me by terrifying Woody."
"We'll have to get the boy examined by a physician within the next few hours."
"He wasn't raped," Megan said. "We don't need to put him through an exam."
"We'll see what he says. I'll need a statement from him."
"As I told you, he doesn't speak."
"Not ever?"
"It's not uncommon in autism."
Carrington's partner, Deputy Argento, alternated between watching the interrogation and returning to the hallway to confer with other deputies. A third car had arrived. The flashing red and blue beacons of the light bars washed the wind-shaken night beyond the windows. Perhaps 6 deputies were in the house. The night crackled with traffic on police band radios and on the various deputies' belt-clipped walkie-talkies. Megan wondered into what rooms they were venturing, what they were examining. She was glad they were here, that they had arrived in time to frighten Shacket away, but she felt violated all over again.
"You dated this Lee Shacket?"
Carrington said.
"A few times, yes, many years ago."
"You had a relationship with him?"
"Not sexual, no. A few dates, nothing more. A long time ago."
"You said he called you earlier today."
"Yesterday, now. He wanted me to go to Costa Rica with him. It was crazy. I turned him down."
They'd been through this before. Megan understood that Carrington was using a circular technique, repeatedly returning to ground already covered to see if Megan's story changed. But it was nonetheless annoying.
"If Shacket didn't have a key, how did he get in the house?"
"I think he came in while Verna was here. She leaves the back door unlocked sometimes because she has to go in and out."
"And Shacket just hid somewhere until you went to bed?"
"That's what I assume."
"Hid out for hours. That sounds awfully patient for a guy who's as crazy as you say."
She made a note.
"You were sleeping, but he didn't come straight for you. He came here to the boys' room."
"Like I said, I wasn't sleeping. I was reading. And then I got sleepy, decided to turn in. That's when I realized my pistol had been put back in the gun safe in the wrong position, and the magazine had been emptied."
"Was the gun safe locked?"
"Yes. I don't know how he got the combination."
"How long have you owned the weapon?"
3 years.
"You purchased it legally in California?"
"Yes.
I'd like to see the registration."
"I'll get it when you're done with your questions."
"You took a safety course in firearms?"
"Like I said, I practice with it once a month, and yes, I took a safety course."
"Did you get the weapon because of Lee Shacket?"
"No. Why would I? By the time I bought the gun, it had been years since I'd seen him,
and he wasn't batshit crazy back then. So you said you wounded him?
Not severely. Maybe tore off part of his left ear.
The kid was present then?
Lying right here as he is now.
You shot toward the kid?
I had to. Shackett threatened to gouge out his eyes.
Is he blind?
What? No, he's not blind.
The way he's just lying there, that fixed stare.
He's not blind. High-functioning autistic.
So have you had him evaluated to see if this is the best environment for him? He shouldn't be in some special care facility?
Megan needed to change the dynamics of this. She let go of Woody's hand and stood up, eye to eye with Carrickton.
This isn't about whether Woody is in the best environment. Is anyone looking for Lee Shackett? He's crazy, and something worse than crazy. Is a search party being organized?
That's not my job, Carrickton said. My job is to get your statement, which I'll need if we're going to convict this guy.
All right, but let's stay focused on what happened here tonight, what Lee Shackett did and tried to do.
Carrickton met Megan's stare in silence for perhaps 10 seconds, her Wedgwood blue eyes as brittle as a china plate, and then said,
You've got a nice big house filled with all the best stuff, but with a problem kid like him to look after, and unstable boyfriends from the past liable to show up, the best stuff doesn't mean much.
Inexplicable animosity, emanating from a total stranger who presumed to know you, was not a frequent occurrence when you were face to face with someone. Social media was a hotbed of it, which was why Megan didn't go online every day. However, in a situation like this, in the physical presence of the apparent hater, she could not just click off and shut down her computer.
I'm not going to go over this endlessly. I'm not a suspect in this. I'm the victim. I'll give you 5 more minutes, that's all.
2 minutes later, Sheriff Hayden Ekman arrived. Chapter 64. In the high redoubt of the southwest tower of Castle Wyvern, Woody was lying in abject self-disgust. This time he knew that he would never be able to pay penance for his weakness, that he would never be going home again. No bluebird would appear to sing a song of forgiveness, and the furry white rat would never dance in delight as a sign that he had paid a proper price for what he'd done, or, as was more often the case, hadn't done. The bad man had called him a dummy. But Woody was no dummy. No one could make him believe that he was stupid just because he never talked. But the bad man also called him useless. Although it was a bad man who made the accusation, that didn't mean the judgment had no merit. It was true, all right. The man had insulted Woody's mom, had worse than insulted her, had told her to take her clothes off, had been going to force her to have sex. Woody was innocent, but he wasn't naive. He knew what sex was. Sex could be a beautiful thing when it was making love, or it could be as ugly as murder when no love was involved. That's what he knew. Through all of it, Woody had done nothing. Nothing. The crazy man's light touch, stroking his cheek, his nose, drawing circles on his chin, tracing his lips with one fingertip, had so shocked Woody, embarrassed him because of his helplessness, that his arms and legs became leaden, and he couldn't lift his head. Though he hadn't at once gone away to Wyvern, he had remained as paralyzed in his own bedroom as he was now here in his crude bed of reeds. He had finally traveled to Wyvern after the shooting was done, when he couldn't rise from the bathroom floor where he'd curled in a corner. His mother had to lift him and carry him and put him on the bed, and his helplessness had never been more mortifying. Now he lay gazing up at the high windows, at the swollen black bellies of the clouds behind which lightning pulsed without shaping itself into bolts, like waves of acid eating through the impending storm. Dragons were in flight in numbers he'd never seen before, flocks of them with long spiked tails and scalloped wings, fearsome harbingers of some apocalypse. No thunder followed the lightning, and no shrieks escaped the dragons, for all was ever silent in this realm, as silent as Woody, until the bluebird sang or the white rat danced, allowing him to go home. But neither of them would appear this time. And there was so much he wanted to say, but the words wouldn't form. When you had never spoken to anyone but a few deer in the backyard, you learned to live with your voice locked inside you. What he said to the deer, "You're beautiful, I love you," was what he wanted to say to his dad, before his dad was gone forever. And it was what he wanted to say to his mother, who might one day be gone forever too. But he was such a mess that he could only say it to the deer,
so he learned to live with that, too. When your mother's arms around you were the best feeling in the world, then you knew that if you could just put your arms around her in return, it would be even better yet. But you learned to live with not being able to hug anyone. He had told himself that she knew how he felt even without the hugs, and most of the time he really believed she did know. But sometimes, like now, he thought maybe she didn't know, that she only hoped he loved her. And he'd even learned to live with that doubt. He wasn't able to live with this, that his mother was almost raped, almost shot, and he did nothing.
Nothing, nothing.
Not only was he incapable of helping her, in his paralysis he had been a burden to her, had almost gotten her killed because he couldn't bring himself to touch, to strike out at, the bad man. He couldn't even run for help. And all this that had happened was maybe because he had visited tragedy on the dark web and had written The Sun's Revenge, faithfully compiled evidence of monstrous evil. Something else the bad man said was true. You know how hot your mommy is? Way too hot to waste her life with a dummy like you. If he never went home, she'd be free of him. If he stayed here in Castle Wyvern, his mom could have a better life with someone who could tell her that he loved her. She could travel places she liked to go and not worry anymore about what might happen to her dummy child. He was smart, but he was nevertheless a dummy. Dumb, mute, speechless, full of learning and full of so many feelings that mattered not at all, because he couldn't share any of what he knew and felt with anyone. In the throbbing of the silent storm light, under the soundless flights of dragons, in the unearthly quiet of the high tower room, where he could no longer hear the crackle of the reeds under him, or his own heartbeat, or his breath drawn and expelled, he suddenly heard a voice.
"I'm coming, boy. I'm almost there."
He lowered his stare from the windows with glass panes and saw the dog again, not curled on the floor this time, but sitting up, a harness around it, as if it was riding in a car.
"Don't cry, boy. Don't be afraid. I'm almost there."
Chapter 65.
Upon being told of the extraordinary home invasion and violence at the Bookman residence, the sheriff had assumed that this incident and the Spader-Kleinman murders might involve the same perpetrator. He had once ordered blockades on Greenbrier Road. They were looking for a red Dodge Demon fleeing the scene, a high-end aftermarket job with the power to outrun any vehicle in law enforcement's fleet. Four men had been assigned to each roadblock, the first one approximately 2 miles south of the Bookman property, the other 1.5 miles to the north. The southern post was fully manned almost at once, and two deputies with one car established a half-adequate barrier at the northern position. Nathan Palmer, if it was Nathan Palmer, had been harried from the Bookman house by the sound of approaching sirens. It was thought that he had gone west on foot, across the backyard of the property, and into the forest rather than risk the highway with patrol cars swarming it. He had surely arrived in his Dodge Demon, however, and secreted it somewhere in the vicinity. He would attempt to circle through the trees to the vehicle. For the past half hour, traffic on Greenbrier Road had been halted and subjected to inspection. Now deputies Walter Colt and Freeman Johnson, the first to arrive at the Bookman residence, departed the house and drove north to fortify that roadblock. Freeman rode shotgun. An ardent woodsman, hiker, fisherman, as well as a deputy, he possessed an acute awareness of the patterns of nature. The Forest Service road they passed on the right appeared as dark in its depths as the bowels of a leviathan. The sidewash of the headlights penetrated only a few feet, yet Freeman detected a visual discordance amid an otherwise vertical blackness of night-shrouded trees.
"Hold it! Turn around," he said. "Something back there on that Forest Service road."
Walter Colt slowed, hung a U-turn, cruised south for a short distance, turned left onto the narrow dirt lane, and clicked the headlamps to high beams. With the light boring directly into the woods, what had been concealed to all but Freeman's intuition now stood revealed approximately 60 or 70 feet from the paved highway. A red sedan. As the patrol car coasted slowly through the trees, and the sedan before them was revealed to be a Dodge, Walter Colt snatched up the police radio microphone and reported the find. He stopped 10 feet short of the perpetrator's vehicle and shifted into park and put on the emergency brake, but he left the engine running. Neither Johnson nor Colt had been at the scene of the Spader and Kleinman murders the previous afternoon. but they had heard that the woman had apparently been ravaged by animals, or carrion-eating birds, perhaps vultures, after her death. They realized that if the attack at the Bookman house involved the same perp, he was both reckless and uncommonly violent, although they were not yet aware that he was something far beyond their combined 36 years of law enforcement experience. In addition to a shotgun-clamped muzzle up to the dashboard, left of the front passenger seat, there was also a 4-foot-long cattle prod for use on animals only. Pinehaven County was home to more wild animals than people, and some of the former were powerful predators, most notably mountain lions, but also bears and coyotes. In Freeman Johnson's experience, there had also been a runaway bull twice, a tiger kept illegally by an idiot who thought it would always be as gentle as a kitten, and a badly abused pit bull that understandably turned savagely against all humankind. Deputies didn't encounter such dangerous creatures every day or even weekly. But because it had long been the policy of the sheriff's department not to shoot any animals except in the most extreme circumstances, there were times when the electric prod was essential. Although the Dodge Demon was dark and silent and seemingly untenanted in the headlight beams that pierced its windows, Colton Johnson exited the patrol car with guns drawn. To an extent, the wild woods raised walls against the power of the wind, although these ramparts weren't impervious. A lesser but still insistent tempest shivered across the forest floor, thrashing whatever undergrowth it found, and a stronger gale fiercely shook the higher boughs of the evergreens. Translated by the deep canopy of needled branches, the upper currents of air sounded like rushing water, as though a great river surged overhead, and within that susurration arose thin shrieks, hollow groans, cries of seeming anguish, as if the river were the Styx, sweeping legions of souls from the world of the living to the land of the dead. Freeman and his partner approached the Dodge with caution, but they also ceaselessly surveyed the eclipsed woods beyond the light provided by their car. That gloom seemed somehow different from any that Freeman had known before, like the fabled outer dark beyond all hope of Eden. If the moment felt fraught with unnatural or even supernatural threat, then the attack came in harmony with the mood, the assailant dropping from a branch high above their line of sight like a winged devil. He crashed hard into Walter Colt and drove him to the ground at the back of the Dodge. The deputy's gun flew from his hand, hit spang on the bumper of the car, and spun away into the shuddering brush. In shock, Freeman reeled back a step, two steps, as Colt heaved and rolled to get atop of, or cast off, his attacker. The deputy was the bigger of the two, but it was at once evident, from the snarling ferocity of his assailant, that size and combat training might not be enough to beat back the assault. The tangled, thrashing bodies, in a frantic struggle, allowed Freeman no easy shot, in fact, no shot at all. He stepped forward to join the fray, intending to club Nathan Palmer on the head with the barrel of his pistol. He halted when Walter Colt screamed. As long as he'd known the man, Colt had never shown fear, never issued a complaint about pain, remained always the definition of stoic. This wasn't merely a scream of pain, but also of pure terror, and carried on it were words, "He's biting! He's biting!" In the glare of the headlights, Colt's left hand was gloved in blood. Not just his left, both hands. Blood on his face, too. The assailant snapping at his throat, Colt fending him off with bleeding hands, attacker slamming a knee into his victim's crotch, slamming and slamming. Palmer glanced once at Freeman, and a slick mass of bloody saliva slid from his mouth across a curve of grinning teeth, his fierce glare bright with animal eyeshine. With no clear shot, in the clutches of fright, Freeman returned to the patrol car, grabbed the cattle prod, which would deliver a high-voltage, low-amperage charge, enough to dissuade a bear or bull, maybe enough to kill a man if applied relentlessly. He was back at the scene in 3 seconds. Colt was still screaming. Department rules forbade the use of the prod on a human being. Fuck the rules. He jammed the copper prongs into Palmer's back. In contact with his attacker, Walter Colt would receive a hard but less disabling subsidiary shock. But there was no helping that. The maniac howled, and Freeman stung him again, and Palmer fell off his victim, face down on the dirt track. Gasping, groaning, Colt tried with only a little success to overcome the shock, to hitch away from his assailant. Palmer should remain paralyzed for 20 to 30 seconds and be disoriented, largely helpless, for a minute or more after that. Freeman slipped a thick plastic zip-tie handcuff from his utility belt. He dropped to one knee beside the prostrate attacker, intending to bind the bastard's wrists tight together behind his back. Palmer flailed, rolled over, tried to sit up, hissing with the fury of a taunted serpent. Heart knocking so hard that it shook his arms, zip-tie slipping from his sweat-slick fingers, Freeman scrambled backward, snatched up the cattle prod. He jammed the copper terminals into the maniac's abdomen. Palmer clawed the hard-packed earth, scoring it as if his fingers were talons and the ground mere sand. Freeman shocked him again. Again, and Palmer tossed his head, the cords in his neck standing out like steel cables, and Freeman gave him yet another jolt, a longer one. At last, Palmer collapsed, unconscious or dead. Freeman didn't care which. He knelt and rolled Palmer face down, and zip-tied the man's hands behind his back. He drew the plastic straps tighter than regulations allowed, then used a second zip-tie, even though he'd never heard tell of anyone breaking free of one. He tightened a zip-tie around each of the man's ankles and connected them with a third. At last, he felt for a pulse in Palmer's neck and regretted that he detected one. During all of that, Walter Colt had managed to crawl to the patrol car and sit with his back against the front fender on the starboard side. He was bleeding from both hands, and the little finger on his left had been bitten off. The forefinger hung loose, but was still attached by a shred of flesh. The ball of his chin had been bitten so severely that it wobbled, as though it would fall off the bone. He was crying like a child, maybe in physiological shock. Freeman Johnson hurried around to the driver's door and got behind the wheel and grabbed the mic. He called for an ambulance.
"Officer down! Critical wounds!"
Gave his position and asked for backup.
"As much damn backup as you can get me!"
Because the batteries in the prod must be nearly depleted. The plastic cuffs would hold, they always held. But someone was going to have to get a bite block in Palmer's mouth before they transported him, and Freeman wasn't going to do that without plenty of assistance. He got out of the car, retrieved the emergency medical kit from the trunk, went around to Walter, and knelt at his side. The hands were bleeding, but not so bad that a tourniquet was required before the EMTs got here. He gave Walter two spools of gauze to squeeze lightly in his fists, to apply pressure to the wounds in his palms. Nothing could be done about the chin.
"Ambulance en route, buddy. They'll be here in 5 minutes. Not long. Sooner than 5.
"Jesus God," Walter said, his voice breaking.
Already Palmer was stirring. He cursed and tried to turn over. He strained his bound wrists and kicked his shackled legs. He arched his back impossibly, as if he might be able to lock his vertebrae in sequence like a snake and curl his upper body erect. But he could not, and so he cursed more furiously.
"For God's sake, what is he?" Walter asked. "Shoot the freak! Kill him while you can!"
His partner's uncharacteristic fear further chilled Freeman. He rose to his feet and retrieved the cattle prod, and stood ready as sirens rose in the distance. Back up. No moon or stars above the narrow service road. The cool wind roaring overhead like the caissons of Armageddon. The forest deep and black and crawling with mystery, as it had never previously been for Freeman Johnson. Chapter 66. Police car light bars flung off glisters of red and blue that washed across the windshield and the dashboard of the Range Rover. Kip and Ben sat in a line of cars at a blockade, northbound on Greenbrier Road. Ben waited more patiently than Kip, who panted with anxiety.
"What's wrong, fella?"
Ben didn't know about the boy, that the boy had been screaming, and was now almost silent on the wire, issuing only a pitiable sound of perfect despair. Two species on this planet have been bonded for many thousands of years. Maybe more than 100,000. Dogs and people. Dogs had been at the side of human beings for millennia before horses or cats. They had hunted together when hunting had been essential for survival. They had protected each other from all threats in a primitive world where nature was even crueler than it was now. Of all the creatures on Earth, only people and dogs engaged joyfully in play all the days of their lives. In the relationship between humanity and dogs, some mutual destiny existed that had not yet been fulfilled, That was what Dorothy had believed. She had been sure that Kip and the others in the Mysterium would represent the next stage in that human-canine destiny, that they would change the world. And now this boy, unknowingly, was able to use the wire, which might mean that, in the near future, the human-dog bond would knit the two species more tightly together. Kip felt that an event of historic importance loomed. The police went slowly from vehicle to vehicle, questioning the drivers, looking in the trunks of the cars. A historic event loomed, and the police delayed traffic on Greenbrier Road, and if Kip became any more frustrated, he would need to get out and pee. Chapter 67 Deputy Carrington and her partner Deputy Argento were gone, Megan's statement having been deemed adequate by Sheriff Hayden Ekman. With the assistance of Argento, the sheriff had set right the overturned highboy and settled on the edge of the armchair to speak with Megan while she remained at Woody's bedside. Having entered the room with a sense of the antagonism between Megan and Carrington, he apologized for his deputy's aggressive style of questioning, but also excused it by asserting that the woman was one of the best in his department. Megan had once met the previous sheriff, Lyle Sheldrake, a low-key, folksy man with a leathery face and white hair that glowed as if irradiated. She hadn't known him, but those who had long experience of him said that he was a dedicated and honest man, whom Ekman had run against and defeated in a campaign of low character. Now, even as the new sheriff sought to smooth away what irritation Carrington had caused, he struck Megan as oleaginous, not trustworthy. These days Americans seemed attracted to such politicians, if they were exceptionally gifted at virtue signaling while they slandered their opponents. Ekman didn't want to rehash all that Megan told Carrington, but he was intently interested that she knew her attacker, and that his name was Lee Shackett.
"To the best of your knowledge, Miss Bookman, has he ever used the name Nathan Palmer?"
"No, not to my knowledge, but I wouldn't know, really. The last time I saw him was at a corporate affair with my husband 8 years ago, and before that, 13 years since I knew him socially."
"You said he was the CEO of Refine Inc., part of Dorian Purcell's empire?"
"That's right."
"Are you aware of the catastrophic fire at Refine's operation outside Springville, Utah?"
"No. I avoid the news, Sheriff. There's nothing I can do about the people who make it, and I'm determined to keep my art positive in a world that increasingly isn't."
"Well, he may be on the run from responsibility for the deaths of 92 people at that facility."
She grimaced, but there was nothing she could say about such a tragedy that would mean anything to anyone. "Then you've even more reason to find him quickly. There's something gone very wrong with him."
"Do you have a photograph of this Lee Shackett?"
"I'm sure you can find one online."
"No doubt, but all we have now is a driver's license he was carrying. It's in the name Nathan Palmer. If you have a photo, Miss Bookman, I could confirm in a minute that they're one and the same."
"It's Mrs. Bookman."
"Yes, of course, if you prefer."
"Lee Shackett was at our wedding. The album I kept has a few snapshots of him. He still looks much the same, except he's dyed his hair. He had a beard for a long while, though not back when I knew him, so it's just the hair that's changed from the photos."
"Could you show that album to me?"
"I'm not leaving Woody. Go downstairs to the study. On one of the bookshelves are 8 or 10 photo albums. It's the white one with gold trim. Bring it to me, and I'll find Lee Shackett for you."
In the sheriff's absence, she spoke softly to Woody, assuring him that they were safe now, that Shackett would be found and would not be returning. Those assurances, however, were hopes rather than certainties, and perhaps the boy detected the difference, for he did not return from whatever deep place in his psyche he had gone. The wind howled down in the house, not a nature sound empty of meaning, but a shriek of blackest madness, conjuring in Megan's mind a painting by the 18th-century Spanish master Francisco Goya, Saturn devouring his children, a nihilistic image of such insane violence that it was capable of inspiring genuine fear in the viewer and weeks of nightmares. Shackett had shattered one of the sidelights flanking the front door. Sam Brickett could fill the frame with plywood till a glazier came to replace the glass. The alarm would continue to function in the meantime. She would arrange to have double deadbolts installed on every door, key locks on the operable sash windows rather than thumb-turn latches. She had a spare magazine for the pistol. From now on, she'd keep it loaded and always with the weapon. She would draw shut the draperies at all the windows, day and night, so that activities in the house could not be observed by anyone outside. And all of that would be for nothing. She wouldn't feel safe, wouldn't be safe, not for a minute, until Shacket was apprehended. In truth, she wouldn't feel safe until he was dead.
We all make mistakes, though, don't we, Megan? I made one when I left my pistol in your kitchen earlier, after I ate that hot bitch's tits.
No, that's not right. It was a steak. In your kitchen, it was a steak, and it wasn't as good as Justine's breasts. The temptation was to take everything he'd said as the ravings of a madman. But he'd indeed left his gun in the kitchen, and Deputy Carrington had asked about the raw steaks on the kitchen floor. The sheriff returned with a white and gold photo album. Megan paged through it and found a good snapshot